You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
Welcome. You're listening to watching the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz, and it is 11/17/21. Well, we've just got word that the current occupant of the White House has ordered the FTC to immediately probe illegal conduct by oil and gas companies. Ooh, sounds really scary. What could they have done to raise his ire? These profiteers, you know, it's always capitalism. It's always the problem. But Octavio Morenza is here with us now from Optimus, and we're going to talk about what is going on here with prices and why price controls are inevitable. Perhaps, perhaps not. If you got a question, you got a comment on it, shoot us an email, kl@carrielutz.com. We answer all. Octavio, great to have you back. So you believe that price controls are inevitable?
I wouldn't go as far as to say they're inevitable. I think they're becoming more likely than not. And the real problem is that inflation is going through the roof. It shows no signs of abating. We're now over 6% annual inflation rate. The Biden administration has an enormous spending package that's going to drive more inflation, though they deny that. They somehow think if we spend this money, we'll bring inflation down. I don't think that's the way things work. And he's got some very smart people out there pushing this idea, people like Janet Yellen. She knows her stuff, or at least I thought she did.
What stuff does Janet Yellen know? She might know her stuff, but that doesn't make her a truth teller here, Octavio.
Well, I thought she studied economics, and I thought she got a PhD in the thing, and I thought she knew that there's demand curves and supply curves, and if you push the demand curve out to the right, things get more expensive, prices go up, you know, if you boost demand, or I thought she knew that. I mean, maybe she doesn't, but to come out there and say that an enormous increase in spending, i.e. an enormous increase in demand, is going to reduce inflation, I can't believe she actually thinks that. It seems to be incredulous. I don't believe she actually believes it for a second.
So, you know, what's inflation? What causes inflation here, Octavio? There's several causes of it, obviously, supply shortages, but that's not really inflation, because when there's supply shortages, certain prices go up, others go down because demand goes down. When you have across the board price increases, that's a direct result of monetary policy, correct?
I think there's no doubt about that. You're absolutely right. I mean, you could think about it in its sort of most basic terms, the way supply and demand exists for any product or good. It also exists for money. So if you increase the supply of money enormously, you're going to reduce its value. But there's a corollary to that also, is that if demand for money stays high, then the value of money will stay high as well. So I think what we're coming through is a phase where there was tremendous demand for cash. People felt unsafe and certain, so they said, let me hold on to cash. Let me put more of my holdings into cash. Consumers did that. Corporations can see that. You can see that in the deposits that U.S. banks are holding on to. It's enormous. It went through the roof through COVID. So a lot of people said, I'm going to hold on to that cash. I'm not going to spend it because I'm uncertain about the future. Now, as things return to normality, people are going to start spending that money. As they spend that money, prices will go up. Demand goes up, prices go up with it. And then you've got some supply chain issues, but I think those are fairly specific to certain ports around the world. It's not by any stretch, I think, a global phenomenon. I think it's more a California port phenomenon more than anything else. It's not really.
It's happening in the UK. They had gasoline shortages, panic buying around the block. Turkeys, they're saying that for Christmas, you're not going to be able to find turkeys in the UK. I think one thing, we tend to like think that everything's happening for the first time always when we see it. But Octavio, there are always shortages of different items, a substantial number at any given time, which is why economists opine the substitute effect. If you can't get turkey, so you'll go buy chicken. And if you can't get chicken, you'll buy fish. And if steak gets too high, well, let them eat cake, right?
Indeed, yeah. And you're absolutely right. Once you see all the prices going up in tandem, you know it's not because something's wrong with the Turkey market. You know there's something systemic at stake. And that systemic thing, the thing that ties all these things together, is money. And it's the monetary policy. And I think that's quite clear. So I think they basically printed so much money over the course of the past year or two, and going back a few more years, that now it's coming home to roost. And they've done it in such a way now that almost feeds inflation directly, i.e. they've sort of printed stimulus checks and handed those out to people who go out and spend the money, of course, and drive up demand and sort of are driving up consumer prices in the way that we haven't seen for quite some time.
Right. So transitory inflation, it's just...
Well, I think the central banks always sort of follow a similar model. Whenever they find inflation gets away from them, the first thing they do is they deny it. They say it doesn't exist. It's not there. It's and then they say it's transitory. It's going to go away soon. Don't worry. And then they start to find excuses and they say, oh, it's because of this, that, and the other, and it's too complicated for you to understand. And then sort of in the final phases, they're blaming foreigners and speculators and capitalists. And then finally, they do something about it. Once they've exhausted all other possibilities, they actually get around to actually getting the inflation under control. But that's a good few years down the road, I think.
Yeah. So in the meantime, you look for all these bogeymen, and you blame everything on them. It's those speculators, those damn speculators. I mean, why do we have them, Octavia? Why don't we just send them all off to prison? And then the economy will be working perfectly, won't it?
I mean, that seems to be the theory. But I guess they don't understand what speculators actually do. You know, speculators, if they're going to be halfway successful, they have to buy low and sell high. And if they're going to do that effectively, they're going to actually stabilize prices, right? Because they're going to buy when prices are low, which will push up prices, and they're going to sell when prices are high, which is going to push the prices down. So you really want a good set of speculators running around to stabilize prices for you. Otherwise, they're going to whipsaw back and forth quite aggressively. So speculators fulfill that role very, very well if they're doing their job well. And if they're not, they're out of business quite quickly, so we don't have to worry about them.
Hey, but, you know, if Shakespeare were writing today, he wouldn't be picking on us lawyers. He would say in his noted work, the first thing we do is jail all the speculators, right? He'd give us lawyers a break today because we're not responsible for anything that's going on.
But surely they had speculators in Elizabethan English. He could have picked on them back then. I mean, they might have called them hedge fund managers back then, but surely they had people speculating, merchants, things like that, evil people driving up the prices of whatever they ate back then. I'm sure that existed there as well. But so the question is, what do they do about this? I mean, it seems they're doing everything to exacerbate the problems, everything to drive the prices up higher, more spending, more buying. In particular, this infrastructure bill, when you look at it, there's a lot of building of infrastructure in it. So that's going to drive construction prices up. The demand for things like concrete, cement, wood, timber, things like that is going to carry on going up. These are energy intensive businesses as well. So they're going to drive the price of energy, of oil, up higher. So that is what the inevitable outcome is of their spending bills. And I think the future risks bring even more of that. So what are they going to do? I think they're going to have to show something dramatic. And inflation is going to become a major political liability for the Biden administration. They're already desperately unpopular. If this carries on a bit further, they're going to become more unpopular, and they're going to have to show they're going to do something decisive, big and bold. And I think that thing is going to be actually implementing price controls of some sort. And they're probably going to take a playbook out of Richard Nixon.
Oh.
50 years ago did this as well. It put into place wage and price freezes right across the board. I'm not sure how he claimed to have the authority to do that, but he did that actually at the stage when inflation was a bit lower than now. So back then, 50 years ago, inflation was only 5.4%. Now we're above 6%, so we're beyond that point. And I think Nixon was finding that inflation was becoming a very, very severe political liability that he had to do something about. And I think Joe Biden's going to feel that too. And they're going to reach for something dramatic, extraordinary, some flourish, some big bang to show that they have it under control. And I think wage and price controls serve that purpose perfectly.
And they are a disaster because we should know this. When Reagan was president, the first thing he did was decontrol the price of oil. And everybody was moaning and gasping. And what happened then? The price of oil fell dramatically. It was down to $10 a barrel. And the price of gasoline, for the last time that I remember, maybe there was a time shortly thereafter, the price of gasoline went down to below $1 US. And as a result, we never had another gasoline shortage or oil shortage ever.
It's funny about that, isn't it? Where as soon as you let the prices float, shortages disappear. As soon as you put price caps into place, all sorts of shortages make themselves evident. But as soon as you let the market forces set the prices, there's no such thing as a shortage. It's kind of extraordinary.
Well, this administration will do for the consumer price index, but rent control has done, price controls in New York City has done to the supply of apartments in New York, and that has basically made it disappear.
I think you're not allowed to call it rent control anymore. You have to call it rent stabilized or something like that.
Stabilization. Yes,
rent stabilization. Yeah, because they promised a long time ago not to do any more rent control in New York because they realized none of the landlords were building anymore and there was a crumbling housing infrastructure as a result. So, but lo and behold, they brought it back, but they called it rent stabilization, not rent control.
Yeah. And as a result, they don't really build apartment houses in New York anymore. They built condominium towers, which the individual investors then rent out to tenants at an uncontrolled rate. And that's how we've gotten around it. I had a professor in law school. I think his name, he was a judge, Judge Berman. I think it was Frederick Berman. Nice man. Well, I think it was... Mayor Beam, and we're going way back here. I hate to like talk about the old days. Basically, gave him the task of coming up with the Rent Stabilization Act, and he thought it was a great success because everybody hated it. The tenants hated it because it didn't control rents enough, and of course, the landlords hated it because it controlled rent too much. So that's the definition of a government success: when everybody hates what you're doing, you must be doing something right.
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Today's show is brought to you by Mustango River Resources. Their flagship projects are located in Kirkland Lake, an established gold camp that has historically produced over 70 million ounces of gold. The Kirkland West Project is a high-grade gold project beside Kirkland Lake Gold's world-class Macassa Gold Mine, one of the highest-grade mines in the world. The Umeja Project is an advanced stage project with 600,000-plus ounces of gold along the Cadillac Break, 25 kilometers east of Macassa. Their projects have the potential to transform into another world-class mining camp in the Kirkland Lake District. Make sure you go over to mustango.com. That's mistango.com. Take a look and sign up for notifications. Stock is traded on the Canadian Stock Exchange, ticker symbol MIS. For more information and to sign up for notifications, go to mustango.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
Well, I tell you, a lot of the landlords saw the value of their property go way down as a result of that. And however, they had, in many cases, still insured the property at the older prevailing rates. So they were sitting on sort of an insurance potential gain and loss. So they had a strong incentive to start to burn down their own houses.
Yeah,
and they did just that. And to make things worse, New York City has sort of a welfare law in place where if you could show you were a victim of a fire or a burning, you would jump to the front of the queue to get subsidized housing. So both the landlords and the tenants had an interest in burning down their buildings. And that's what happened. You had burned out buildings all over the Bronx.
All over the Bronx.
Burning. Amazing.
Yeah, that was... what they called it, Fort Apache was the precinct, and it was killing people right and left, and the place was burning down, hundreds of fires every night. Atlantic City, same thing kind of happened there. There's different economic forces involved. So, Octavio, from your perch over on the other side of the pond here in Europe, you see that we are losing in New York Comrade de Blasio, which I have mixed feelings about, because he was he could be the butt of any joke. He was a moron. All his policies were misguided, communistic, stupid. I mean, the guy was not what you call a thinker. He was a man of a very finite intellect, put it that way. And now he's gone. I don't know. Do you follow any of this? Do you care about who the mayor of New York is? What's your take?
Well, I mean, being a former New Yorker myself, I do have a sort of a feel for the city, and my son studies there. So yeah, so but I personally do. I don't think most Europeans are going to be aware of sort of New York City politics and who the mayor is and who the president of Manhattan borough is and things like that. But I'm a bit unusual in the sense that I used to live in New York, have a child in New York. Before COVID, used to go to New York on a very regular basis. So it's been some time now. But no, so I definitely keep an eye on that. And it's sort of an interesting bellwether, I think, for the rest of the America. I mean, New York is, of course, quite distinct from the rest of the US. It has a different political climate and culture and things of that sort. But to a certain extent, it is a bellwether for the rest of America, I think, to get an understanding of what's going on in people's heads. And de Blasio, but you know, there have been other New York mayors who have not exactly covered themselves in glory over the course of the past few years.
Well, Bloomberg, all right. Bloomberg spent 3 terms, 12 years in office. Giuliani, 8. 20 years combined, turning that place around, getting infrastructure improved, which is really crucial in a city like New York with aging infrastructure and bridges ready to fall down all over the place, but making it safe, you know, really bolstering businesses as much as you can in New York, because these big cities by nature have to be anti-business. It just seems that way, certainly in the Northeast. All these things they managed to accomplish. And this guy, like in the blink of an eye, undid everything. And then you have a guy coming in who's a former cop, Democrat, running as a law and order candidate, which is, I don't remember the last time I saw one of those. It might have been during the LBJ John F. Kennedy era, the last time we had a law and order. Next thing, he'll be supporting strong national security, Octavio.
I'll hold my breath on that one and see what comes up. It's just that I think some of these policies have become so unpopular and must be unpopular, even behind the people who they're supposedly out to help. They just have to sort of throw in the towel and say, yes, we do need a police force, and we do need to maintain some level of law and order, and it doesn't work any other way. De Blasio didn't seem to really realize that, and amazingly, I don't know. We seem to keep making the same mistakes, though. And I mean, you said he wasn't an intellectual heavyweight. I mean, I think that's probably true. But I am sort of searching for who the intellectual heavyweights are on the left. I sort of would like to find them and engage with them, because I just don't know who they are.
AOC, she's an intellectual heavyweight.
That's what they say. That's what I've heard.
When you dumb down everything, you know that old saying, Octavio, in the land of blind men, the one-eyed man is king, right? And that's what we're dealing with here. Anyway, I don't want to talk about politics, because it's really not a question of politics. It transcends political party. It transcends ideology, you know. All of these policies, bad policies, make everybody poorer. You know, the crowding out effect. The more money the government consumes, the more resources it consumes, the less that's available to private industry to build, to expand their businesses, and to raise living standards, because government, as we know, cannot improve the standard of living overall. They can pick winners and losers, and their favored class, their living standards can improve, but the rest of the society pays for it. Well, anyway, enough of this. They're not going to invite us to any parties in the salons of the left of leftist New York, that's for sure. But defund the police, what could possibly go wrong? Everything is great. So let's get back to this concept here of wage and price controls, because it comes from the same political naivete, same political stupidity, the lack of knowledge of how economic forces really behave.
Well, I agree with you, but maybe that is not even the point. I mean, for Nixon, when he did it, you have made all the same arguments, you know, that Nixon was not perhaps the economically most literate person, or maybe he was, but he had a feel for politics, and maybe that transcends this and more important. Bear in mind that after Nixon did this, he rode into a landslide re-election. So it was actually a very popular move. Now, the general populace perhaps didn't quite understand the economics behind it either, but he was able to win the next presidential election after that with quite a large majority. I mean, landslide, I think he won in, I can't remember how much of the Electoral College he won, but it was overwhelming. It was an overwhelming victory.
I think the only states that McGovern won were Minnesota and Massachusetts, maybe. So he won 48 states, and we've never seen a landslide like that since. But I think people are a little wiser now, maybe from the work of Milton Friedman et al., in that making people understand that inflation, which we define inflation here as consumer price increases, are first and foremost a monetary phenomena. Octavio, just tell us, where do we find you on the web again? How do we connect with you, and why should we?
You can find me at opimas.com, O-P-I-M-A-S.com. And why should you connect with me? I mean, we look at financial services and investments and things of that sort. So that's basically the area that we're in, advising financial institutions and providers in capital markets. So that's the area that we're active in.
That works for me, Octavio. You're a sage advisor. If you got a question for Octavio, shoot us an email, kl@carrylutz.com. Sign up for a free newsletter on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Octavio, it's always great catching up with you. You bring such a fascinating perspective. Until you mentioned wage price controls, honestly, and that's what we're looking. It was called under Nixon wage and price controls. Till you mentioned that, it never dawned on me that we're headed down that path. Now that you mentioned it, it's as obvious as the nose on your face. That's where we're heading. Appreciate your giving us the insight into that. And you know what? I'm going to mark this show, because there's going to come a time, probably in 6 months to a year, where we both get to say a big, I told you so.
I hate people to do that, but I'm looking forward to this one to be able to do that.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.